Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy. How's it going today?
It's going pretty well. We do have some housekeeping stuff real quick. A couple episodes ago, we made a mistake about the constitutional amendments, and I just wanted to clear it up before somebody starts yelling at us with nasty email messages. We had said that the 27th Amendment was where 18-year-olds get to vote. That turns out to be the 26th Amendment. The 27th Amendment has something to do with Congress putting in raises during their term, I guess is how that one goes. And I don't know if you know
Yes.
how to fill them. Okay, so you do know that one. Okay. So I just wanted to clear that up. And you have a little bit of an announcement that you want to make about a call coming up for NARSAL.
Yes, I do. The Christmas holiday is coming really quickly for a lot of people. That represents a time of loneliness and isolation. And for those who are in this sex offender registry supervision scheme, they have all sorts of restrictions that prohibit them from engaging in some activities. So the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws is planning on having a Christmas Eve conference call, and we're going to invite people to call in and talk about anything that they would be doing, but they're prohibited from doing it. And we're going to listen to those reports and see if there's anything actionable within those restrictions that might violate the separation of church and state, for example. If a person would like to be in a church play with their kids viewing it and they can't. So this will be at 6 o'clock Eastern time on December 24th, and all you have to do is go to narsal.org and click on the events calendar, and the event is already calendared, and we're looking forward to having people sign up and listen in. If you just want to listen in, offer support for those who are isolated on the holidays, which we all know that suicides and loneliness are a big thing. Suicides go up by some remarkable percentage during the holidays. So NARSAL's trying to provide some outlet for those who are isolated on Christmas.
And with suicide rates being higher at the holidays and suicide rates being higher for people under supervision like this, you might have a compound effect, huh?
Well, that's our hope. We've never done it before. It may be that no one is interested, but we hear feedback about all the things that we should be doing to be more supportive. So we thought we would take a small step and try to do something supportive on Christmas and see what the reaction is.
Excellent. Sounds good. Well, with that being done, tonight's topic, this is episode 7, is going to be about punishment. How are we going to define punishment for people convicted of different levels of crimes? And I guess we could even go over maybe how that has changed over time from where the foundings were, and even before that, what was acceptable punishment and where we stand now, probably down to the point of what is cruel and unusual punishment, and how do we get that defined? I don't know if we want to say objectively. How do you objectively define punishment being equitable to somebody? Yeah, that sounds like an interesting avenue to take.
Well, let's do it. Let's talk about punishment.
All right. So, in doing some research here, I'm gonna do a quick little bit of reading. And so, the definition of punishment is the infliction of some kind of pain or loss upon a person for a misdeed. In criminal law, punishment is allowed due to the wrongful intent involved in a crime. Punishment such as incarceration seeks to give any victim involved retribution against the offender, deter the criminal from future criminal acts, and hopefully rehabilitate the offender. This is distinguished from civil law, which seeks to compensate the injured party rather than punish the wrongdoer. We should probably go into that because most of these sexual allegations that are going on fall outside of the statute of limitations, so the only avenue that the victim has is to go after these people, I guess even like Bill Cosby, for civil punishment, right? And civil law. So, what's the right word there?
Well, I think Bill Cosby is under criminal charges, or
Oh.
some of his allegations were not beyond the statute of limitations.
Okay.
So, but as a general rule, with the statute of limitations, you would have some that would be many that would be outside of zone of prosecution because of the elapsed time. And that's what we've talked about in terms of the importance of the statute of limitations and the erosion of the statute of limitations as a result of this.
So, if it falls outside of the statute of limitations, then the only avenue is civil law, and then nobody goes to prison for that. You just get your wallet scraped, right?
That is generally true. There are punitive damages that can be awarded in civil litigation on top of actual damages. And I don't know that I'm qualified well enough to explain all the aspects of punitive damages, but as a general rule, at the punitive damages or something that really shocks the conscience of the court, is to send to send a deterrent message to the actor that what they did was really, really over the top, and it's a message to the community. But actual damages and punitive damages are both a part of civil litigation as well.
Okay. And you and I have talked on the phone before about the length of time after a certain window. I think you've said somewhere between 2 or 3 years, if I'm not mistaken. After somebody is in prison for more than a couple of years, you have lost the impact of changing the mindset, of changing the attitude. So then after that, it really just turns out to be punitive and not trying to rehabilitate. Is that right? Or deter, I guess.
I've read that, and I can't cite to the particular article, but it's one of those things where, even though I can't cite to the article, it's certainly logical. You take a person who, when you take them out of society, society moves on without them. So unless there's some heavy duty training and constant updating of that person's skills, their skills and their relationships are deteriorating with their separation from society. So you have a person who's been in prison for a long number of years. The world has passed them by. So when they come out, they're at a disadvantage. And that's one aspect of it. But the other aspect is that people have to acclimate to a prison environment, and they acclimate and they adjust to the prison life, which it's a whole different set of rules in prison. So a person serving a long prison sentence develops a prison mentality of institutionalization and not having to be responsible for daily decisions that you would make in the outside world. So you've got a highly institutionalized person who the world has passed them by when they're released, with very little supportive structure, because taxpayers don't like to spend a lot of money on people that are reintegrating. They think that hopefully they've learned their lesson and they'll go do well. And that's not realistic if a person's been locked up for a number of years. If you've been locked up 10 years, can you just look back on the change? Where were we in terms of technology 10 years ago versus today?
I encountered a bunch of people that had never used an ATM card, and I just can't even comprehend how that could be. But yeah, it's like, I've never used an ATM card. How do you get money from a bank with an ATM card, Larry?
I wouldn't know, because Atlanta was on the forefront of where I'm from, and ATM cards have been around since the 70s. So it's hard to imagine that you've not encountered an ATM card. But what's less difficult to imagine is all the things that we do online now in terms of filling out applications. The superhighway of information, and a person who comes out who's never been on the information superhighway, because that's not one of the things they offer in prison, they don't even know how to go about applying for a job. When's the last time you've been in a place where they actually took paper applications that you can think of?
I go by a Burger King and they say apply at BK online or whatever the URL is. You don't even go inside and see the manager anymore.
So you've got a person who has probably very little interviewing skills in terms of, that's not something I'm aware of that most prisons teach. They don't have a lot of current stuff on their resume to fill in the gap of time. They probably have a very limited wardrobe, and they don't even know how to go about applying for the job in a reasonable fashion in terms of how the economy has changed. So if they possess the skills to do the job, they don't know how to get in the front door. There's just so many barriers. So in terms of your question, the effectiveness of incarceration diminishes in terms of deterrent value, because you get the maximum shock early on. And prison is something that you want a person to fear and not to acclimate to. So once they've acclimated to it, they no longer fear it. And the longer they live in prison, the fewer options they have. When the outside world comes, people are actually feel like that I couldn't even begin to survive in the outside world. This is my home.
Yep.
So you've flipped the situation over where they no longer feel comfortable and want to be free in some cases. And so prison has very little value other than to perpetuate its existence, because so many people come back when they cannot succeed in the outside because of the long sentence that was imposed on them, and very little was done to help them succeed when they were.
All right. So let's take this to the other extreme, though. 15 years ago, maybe in the Netherlands, there was a guy that made this rampage on, I think it was like a Young Republican summer camp or something like that, and he killed 60-ish people. And the maximum sentence in that area, and I could have the country wrong, but the maximum sentence that the guy could get for killing all of those people was 21 years. Are you familiar with that event?
I'm not placing that case at the moment.
God, I wish you would have. Okay. Well, so, but just abstractly, forget where it is and that. So somebody goes out and goes on a, you know, serial killing spree and mows down 50-ish something people. Many of them are children, at least, you know, young adults, whatever. And in that country, their system says that the maximum penalty for that crime, murder, is, and this is, you know, not just one, but many, is 21 years. And I get what you're saying about, you know, after a couple of years, the shock of it. But I guess another piece of the puzzle of prison is for public safety of getting the person off the street.
Well, I would imagine that there's been that discussion held in that country. If that was an adult, rather than a young offender, a juvenile offender, if that was an adult and that was the maximum that they had available to them, I'm sure they're debating the efficacy of their laws, because there is the component of protection from the public at which prisons serve for a person who's incorrigible. But too often we define incorrigible far too broadly. Most people wouldn't disagree that Charlie Manson was probably incorrigible. But even though he was incorrigible, at what point did he cease to be a threat to the society? I'm not saying I advocated that he had been paroled, but at what point does a person become no longer a threat because of their age and debilitated state of health? Was Charlie Manson a threat all the way up to the day he died? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, and is it then the public is going to say, is it worth the risk since he did? But he didn't do any of the killings in the first place, right?
It's my recollection. I was quite young in 69, but I believe his role was inspiring these young women.
Right, right.
To carry out these acts on his behalf, because he was some kind of god, and he had them under a spellbound worship, as I remember. But I was like 11 years old when that was going on.
Yeah. So this was in 2011, the Norway attacks, 77 lives. This guy, and like I said, it was in Norway. It started with a car bomb and then moved on to killing. I'm going to give you the link. We can take a pause. We don't have to dig this one out too deep, but if you look at the document, you click on that link. So we're still taking a quick little break. I just want to find where the guy, I want, because I'm almost positive that the guy, that country, it's 21 years.
There's a 32-year-old right-wing extremist.
Yep.
And charged with both attacks. The trial against him took place in Oslo, admitted having carried out the action, but denied criminal guilt and claimed defense was.
And if you go down to the legal proceedings block,
it says Breivik was convicted and charged and sentenced to 21 years of preventative detention in prison.
That's
the maximum sentence allowed in Norway.
That's crazy. All right. So
it says at the end of the expiration of which the sentence can be extended indefinitely in 5-year increments, says at the time, as long as the prisoner is deemed a threat to society. So they do have a safety valve there.
Okay. So yeah, he might not get out in 21 years. That puts us what, at 2032. So there's a little bit of time left. All right. You ready to go on?
So yeah, let me close this so I can get back to your screen. All right.
All right. So then the other piece of this puzzle is that in the U.S. Constitution, the Eighth Amendment states excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishment inflicted. A number of states' constitutions contain similar or similar provisions. How do we define what is punishment in the context of these crimes that people commit? You know, we can run the gamut of what crimes, but you know, this podcast is primarily dealing with sexual offenses. Everybody goes to the same prison. I guess there are different levels of prisons, but they classify these as being the most violent of crimes. So they put you in with literally serial killers and aggravated assault people. It's insensitive for me to say violent people when you're being put in prison for a violent crime. But these people are predatory from like a savanna, kind of like the deserts of Africa with lions and tigers. Prison is not a safe place to be.
Well, I would agree with that prisons are inherently dangerous places to be. And the more advanced states that have evolved in some way, and you may not believe this, but your state of Georgia was actually fairly evolved at one time. You had some innovative thinkers running the Georgia Department of Corrections, as it was earlier known, the Georgia Department of Offender Rehabilitation. But you had a secretary named Dr. Alan Ault, who was really a forward thinker in Georgia and tried to build into the prison system in Georgia more rehabilitation. And classification is what you're actually describing in terms of how you segregate and classify inmates so that, you're not putting predators with, and I don't mean that in terms of a sexual predator, but you're not putting, one of the most dangerous things in prison is a predation by stronger, meaner inmates on the weaker. So Dr. Ault understood those things and tried to build a classification, a screening system, and build sufficient institutions so there could be segregation and more opportunity for inmates who were rehabilitable to seek that rehabilitation. And that's why they called it the Georgia Department of Offender Rehabilitation in those days. But as the attitudes have changed in Georgia, they're not really on the forefront anymore in terms of Dr. Ault's thinking. The policymakers of the state, in the case of state offenses, decide how much they're willing to put into having safe prisons. And safe prisons cost money. You've got to have very good classification systems. You've got to have very good staffing to monitor the inmates to see that they're abiding by the rules, so that the inmates who think they can get into a soft prison and that they can exploit what's going on and that they can evade the rules, they have to be dealt with quickly. And they have to be moved out of those facilities so that they don't disrupt the rehabilitation environment. But rehabilitation itself costs money. You have to have educators. You have to have therapists. You have to have good counselors. And when people are looking where to work in their career, I can't think of the last time. I'm really struggling to think of the last time when when you start talking to a young person about what is your career objective. I've never heard anyone say, when I get my degree, I want to go work with felons in prison and rehabilitate them.
Absolutely not.
It's not a desired occupation. So you don't attract the best of the best, but it's not to say that they're not good people in prisons. There are.
Of course.
But it's just not a career choice that people want to make that are striving for great achievements to say that my goal is to work in a prison system. So it's a struggle all the way around, even in the enlightened folks' mind, how to pull that off with financial constraints that they operate under. But is your state legislature, which ultimately is the state population that determines how much rehabilitation versus punishment goes on inside those walls.
And also the officers aren't exactly well paid.
Well, I would tend to agree with that, but that's a political decision that has to be made when you're looking at paying. State assemblies have to decide how much a lot of folks make, and state police officers and school teachers in my state, because the state picks up the tab for education, but school and universities, and you've got all these places, public health, that are competing for dollars and trying to, if you go out and run on a campaign in most places saying, I'll tell you one thing, I'm running for office, and one thing I promise I'm going to do is our prison guards are being grossly underpaid and our rehabilitation efforts are being undermined by the fact that we're not paying enough. That's just not a seller that you'll get a lot of applause in your community functions when you try that.
So under the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, cruel and unusual punishment includes torture, deliberately degrading punishment. I want to hover on that one for a minute. Punishment that is too severe for the crime committed. This concept helps guarantee due process. We've been talking about a lot lately too, even to convicted criminals. Many people have argued that capital punishment should be considered cruel and unusual punishment. Deliberately degrading punishment. So Joe Arpaio making people wear pink underwear and have the hot showers and all that stuff. How do you not classify that as degrading and torture?
Well, is that specific language in the Eighth Amendment or is that an interpretation that you've picked up? Because I'm not recalling that language.
Well, yeah. So I think that came from a Wikipedia article on how you would define cruel and unusual punishment.
So I believe the Eighth Amendment, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I believe the Eighth Amendment is far more limited in its language in terms of how cruel and unusual punishment. I believe it leaves it up to judicial interpretation, but we can take a look at the Eighth Amendment. But is any aspect of the Constitution, it's up for judicial interpretation in terms of what was meant. And we've touched on it in a previous podcast. It's the attitude of most conservative jurists, judges, that you interpret what the framers meant by what words meant at the time they were written. You can't look out 240 years. You have to look at what they would have considered cruel and unusual at that time.
Right.
And anything that was acceptable in colonial times should be acceptable today, because this notion of evolving standards of decency is poppycock as far as they're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly capital punishment was quite common in colonial times. So therefore, it would be difficult for a person who believed as strict constructionist to come up with that being cruel and unusual punishment, because it was widely used at the time, and the framers had in mind, they knew that, and they framed the Constitution prohibiting something that was widely used at the time. And if they had been trying to eliminate capital punishment, they would have said that, wouldn't they?
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah, they would have pulled up those things if they could see into the future.
But if they had perceived capital punishment to be cruel and unusual, don't you think they would have said cruel and unusual punishment as well as capital punishment? They could have added those words in there. So, as far as a conservative jurist is concerned, we're inventing something that the colonial times was quite comfortable with, capital punishment. So therefore, it's not cruel and unusual. And then when they go beyond cruel and unusual punishment, what others want to argue is cruel and unusual, it's hard to find other forms of punishment cruel and unusual if putting someone in the electric chair isn't, or the gas chamber.
Yeah, sure.
It's hard to, if you can be alive at the end of any other punishment, it's hard to imagine that that's cruel and unusual. But now they did not widely use torture as a punishment in the colonial times. Officially, it was unofficial, but it was not an officially imposed punishment. There was many lawmen in the old days that took justice into their own hands and did what they thought was best. But including torture, that's why in the Earl Warren years, they made it clear about what happens when you gain a confession by coercion. Those confessions are thrown out because the prosecution shouldn't bear the fruit of something that they've extracted by physical. You remember in the let's see, it was one nation, Singapore, back when Bill Clinton was president. You remember the guy that got caned?
No.
He did some graffiti over in Singapore.
Okay.
And he got caned, and the president of the United States at the time, Clinton, asked Singapore to reduce or not impose the punishment because it was barbaric and as far as Western standards, but they didn't see it that way. It was imposed by a court, but the president or the head of the government did intervene and reduce the number of straps of strokes that the person, I think he cut it from like 6 to 4 or from 8 to 4 or something, but there was a reduction of how many. But the guy was caned. It brought blood. That would never be tolerated in the United States because of our belief that you're not supposed to torture people. So putting someone in the town square and striking them with a cane until blood is oozing from their buttocks, that would not be tolerated.
Right.
So that would cross the line.
Okay. I ended up getting that definition of the from the dictionary. And in this particular case, it's dictionary.com. Includes that language that I said, deliberately degrading punishment or punishment that is too severe for the crime committed.
Well, but I'm saying the Eighth Amendment, I don't think, said that.
I'm with you. I'm with you on the distinction there. But I'm just, that's how I ended up getting that information. And that's what the definition is. And I realize that that's not necessarily a legal definition. But if our standard of what would, if death doesn't constitute cruel, then anything less than would not be cruel. So you could just do anything you want and it wouldn't be considered cruel.
Well, but it would have to be something that was allowed in the times of, if you're litigating this to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is dominated by conservatives right now, you would have to show them that it was something that was not tolerated or acceptable in colonial times.
But even
to get the decision.
Right.
Death was accepted as capital punishment.
But there was, in the prison system in California in roughly 08, they brought up that it was cruel and unusual punishment that they, you know, you couldn't even have like socks. People would just steal your socks. They didn't have enough capacity in the system to provide people with basic clothing. And they won that case. And the federal government was forcing them to draw down their population.
In the area of prison litigation, which has been curtailed in recent years with the Prison Litigation Reform Act, I believe that was 96, 98. It's much more difficult to prevail, but you can in a captive situation, because the responsibility in a captive situation shifts because the person can't fend for themselves. So we have a higher degree of care expected, and the courts have recognized that. Even conservative courts recognize that there's a higher standard of care. The person can't go out and see their own doctor, so you have to provide basic medical care. The person can't do most things for themselves. So if you reach the ridiculous high population that they had reached in California with their proposition, their three strikes proposition. I forget which number that was, but the public had voted for three strikes, and they were running at least twice or maybe more than twice the capacity of the design for the prison.
Correct.
So the courts did hold that those conditions, the lack of proper medical care and sanitation and so forth, did constitute cruel and unusual punishment. They didn't opine about the three strikes law. That was a misunderstanding, people. They didn't say you can't lock people up for life. You can lock them up for life all you want to.
Right.
But they said you cannot lock them up in these conditions. So if you want to lock all these people up, you're going to have to pony up, and you're going to have minimal health care, minimal space requirements for everybody, minimal sanitation requirements. And California didn't want to afford that.
Right.
So then they twisted the argument around and tried to say that the federal courts are making us release all these people. No, they're not making you release a soul. They're telling you that if you're going to house these people, these are the standards of care that you have to, and it's your choice of whether you want to build your way out of this or if you want to release your way out of this.
Right, right.
But yes, that in fact did happen.
I'm with you. Now I'm really stuck on where we are with this being like the definition from just layperson dictionaries versus what legal dictionaries would be. And I'm kind of stuck on where to go. Because if you have the terms in there of deliberately degrading punishment, then a lot of the things that the registry does in having your driver's license marked with sex offender on it could probably be argued that that's deliberately degrading.
Well, it could be, and it will be argued that. But the problem with that argument is that the registry is not a part of your punishment.
Right. But having your photo, you know, having like separate colors on your driver's license so that the cops immediately know if you get pulled over, if you try and go buy alcohol, the people automatically know who you are. And that seems First Amendment compelled speech kind of thing, deliberately degrading, and ultimately the punishment that's too severe for the crime, depending on what crime you committed.
Well, you're in this catch 22 because the registry has not been proven to be punishment in very many circumstances. It's been held to be a civil regulatory scheme. Now, we do have the cases we've had with the Mudez decision in Pennsylvania, and those versus Snyder in Michigan, and the Starkey case in Oklahoma. There are some cracks in the armor where that the lawmakers have gone too far. But the regulatory scheme, as long as it's being held to be civil regulatory, the components within that scheme are just simply a part of the regulatory scheme. And those are going to have to be litigated, and they're going to have to say that in addition to what you previously considered the last time you looked at this, when they go to court, you need to look at this aspect of the regulatory scheme that's being required and see if you believe this inflicts punishment. I'm not overly optimistic about the marking of the driver's license because the 10th Circuit just pronounced in Carney a week or 10 days ago that they didn't view that marking on the driver's license to be punitive. And that's the second highest tribunal in the country, a circuit courts of appeals. So the 10th Circuit, which is my state, Oklahoma, Rocky Mountain states, that they didn't find any problem with it, with marking the driver's license.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you where the 10th Circuit is. So in that article that you wrote for the Narsal Digest, the individual is asking the question about the disparity in sentences. And I know that we covered that to some degree on the last podcast. But in my research for this episode tonight, people get crazy different sentences for various kinds of crime, where we have found... And I didn't mark down a specific example, but so Jerry Sandusky, the Penn State coach, he got 60 years for 45 counts. And then Jared Fogle, the guy from Subway, he got 15 years. And I don't remember how many counts it was. And he also then had a massive amount of money as part of his punishment. And I didn't read anywhere that Jerry Sandusky had any financial stuff associated with his sentence. In us talking about how to define punishment, where do those financial elements kick in dealing with the punishment of somebody?
That's a great question, and we should clarify that in these two cases you've got state court versus federal court. Sandusky was prosecuted in the state of Pennsylvania in state court, and Sandusky was prosecuted in federal court because of his interstate travel. They asserted jurisdiction, and don't know whether that would have been a viable challenge. If there might not have been jurisdiction, but his defense team should have raised it if it was a viable challenge to the jurisdiction. So we have two different sentencing schemes at play here.
Okay.
In state court versus federal court. The federal court system is much more likely to extract restitution, large amounts of financial. So when you're talking about the money, are you talking about restitution to his victims, or are you talking about actual fines? Because I'm not familiar with Fogle's actual sentence.
All of the above. So at least, you know, from the article I read, he got $175,000 in fines, a forfeiture of $225,000 in assets, in addition to $1.4 million in restitution. Do me a favor and tell me what those different things are, because they're all dollar bills to me.
Well, I will tell you this, that level of economic extraction would not have been imposed on a person who didn't have those resources available to them. So if a guy was working a minimum wage and had the same conviction that Fogle did, those monetary things would not have been imposed, because they would not be realistic. So there is an analysis of the person's ability when you're talking about fines and restitution. Particularly fines in terms of penalty. A penalty, a $100 fine doesn't hurt Bill Gates very much.
Right.
But a $100 fine might hurt a minimum wage person quite a bit. So if your goal of the penalty is to make sure that they feel some sting, there has to be some consideration of the ability to pay that penalty, because otherwise it would be meaningless for some.
Which is why when you go back to the lady that had her leg burned from McDonald's with the scalding hot coffee, that they, you know, whatever her burns, whatever her mental anguish and so forth cost, but to actually kick in the pants at McDonald's, you know, a multinational company, you have to throw something pretty substantial at them to be like, oh, whoa, we need to change our policy.
Well, that's a good analysis, because that's exactly what happened in that case. It originates from my state of New Mexico, so I'm a little bit more familiar with it, although I wasn't working in the business at that time. That case predates, I think it was in the 90s sometime.
Yeah, that I happened. Think around that time.
But what happened was is that the coffee was so hot. Everybody knows coffee was hot, even that lady. But apparently there had been a number of attempts by two McDonald's made to downgrade the coffee to a lower level than what they were doing, and they didn't want to, because for whatever reasons, I think the plaintiffs argued that it was that they would be able to serve less coffee, because if it stayed hotter longer, you couldn't drink it. So that was their theory that they put forward. I mean, think about it, if it's scalding hot, how
of
would
course,
you be able to consume
of
it?
Of course. I thought it was so that it would be hot when you got to work.
But that was the theory they put forth. But the fact that they had been asked repeatedly to reduce it by 30 degrees or whatever it was, and they said, we don't give a damn about what you think. This is what we're going to do. So it was to try to get their attention. So there was a punitive aspect of that. But the burns were severe. And it was an older lady. And, right. And she did suffer quite a bit. I don't know if it was $300,000 worth. But it's hard to put a value on that. But it was to send a message to McDonald's to rethink what you're doing. And it got their attention. They did reduce the temperature of their coffee. And they do now have warnings on the labels, which probably weren't needed. But they now have warnings on their cups.
But you can't convict a company of criminal charges, can you?
Well, I think actually you can, but I don't know if I'm qualified to say for certainty. But yes, I think it rarely happens. But I believe that companies can be.
You don't see Ronald McDonald serving time in jail, though.
I haven't seen Ronald himself, but I believe that companies can be held criminally accountable. The particular decision makers could be. If there was criminality, but this wasn't criminality. This was negligence.
Yes,
this case.
Of course.
This was indifference to any adverse ramifications of their policy. They didn't care. They said, if we're McDonald's and this is what we want and this is what we're going
to
do.
I have something that just occurred to me, though, that so during the whatever it was 2012 campaign with Mitt Romney, that he said corporations are people too. So couldn't if corporations now have the privilege of putting money into campaigns, couldn't they also be convicted of crimes and put in jail?
Well, that's the progressive response to that, or the ruling that came down to that
Citizens United.
Citizens United infamous ruling that declared that corporations can give unlimited amounts because they're people too. That's the progressive response as well. When are you going to start executing some of them?
Right.
Because we execute people. And if corporations are people, then when are we going to execute the first one? So If they're people too, it stands to reason that they could be prosecuted. And like I said, I do believe they can. It's not very often. You may push your age. Do you remember the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India, back in 84, I believe, 84, 85?
I do not.
Well, there was this massive explosion in carbide facility in Bhopal, India. And the company president was named Warren Anderson, as I recall. And you might want to do a little Googling while I'm trying to recollect, and you can feel free to correct what I'm wrong, because I'm thinking it was 84, 85, and the town was Bhopal, India, and the Union Carbide Corporation was headed by Warren Anderson. As I recall, the Indian government wanted him extradited, and the United States refused. And so there was hundreds of people died in that explosion. And we're always quick to demand extradition on the U.S. side when somebody's in another nation for something that we think that they should be held accountable for under our law. But we weren't so quick to turn over Mr. Anderson to the Indian authorities.
So it happened, you were right, in the 80s. So it happened in December, early December. So exactly this time of year, 1984. And there were a confirmed 3,787 deaths. And over
I'm way off. I was thinking it was hundreds, so it was thousands.
And then over 500,000 people were exposed to methyl isocyanate gas and other chemicals.
And to my recollection, no one was held accountable on the criminal side for that incident.
But that's happened a bunch of times, like in the coal mine disasters. Massey is what's come into my mind, and that's in the last 5 or so years with the various coal mines that have collapsed. And I don't think any of those executives were held accountable for those things.
Well, it's unfortunate, but.
And same thing with the financial collapse with all the banks and all the gazillions of people that lost their homes from these people doing the toxic assets. And no one, not a single bank person was held accountable for all that stuff.
That's one of the disappointments on the progressive side of the Obama administration, Department of Justice. They did not seek any criminal punishment for those who drove us over the cliff and for their. It was not only that they just made mistakes, and we're getting way off the rails here, but it's not only that they made mistakes in terms of their judgment. They made deliberate mistakes to mask what they were doing and to be deceptive and to achieve the results of putting an untrue representation out in the financial world to sell these toxic assets that were worthless or virtually worthless to bona fide investors. So it was outright fraud. And Bernie Madoff is sitting in prison for similar conduct.
Yeah, he with this good old Ponzi scheme. Well, I think it's relevant in respect to talking about punishment and that it's somewhat of a unbalanced system. And to go down the rabbit hole of being unbalanced, I don't know how to describe this one very well. But if you go into a much more area that doesn't have as much money and the people in those environments, they get. Just anything can break them financially, whereas somebody might get a $100 speeding ticket and they just, whatever, no big deal. They pay it and move on. But that $100 speeding ticket or failure to put on a turn signal, and I get you've made a mistake and all that stuff, and that can just put you on this perpetual cycle of not being able to pay a bill, and then you got to deal with bonds people, and now you've lost your job. And it's horribly devastating, and it doesn't seem that that would be fair punishment since we were just talking about... If like Jared Vogel had the means to pay those huge fines, so the judge makes him pony up the dollars for that.
That's one of the tragedies of our criminal justice system. We've got, I don't want to actually name any towns to pick on them, but we've got towns who finance a significant amount of the operations of their government off of extracting penalty assessments related to very minor infractions. And they're towns that frequently the people are struggling. They're not affluent places to start with. So you have people who get caught in the vicious cycle that they've gotten a ticket. They were assessed the fine plus court cost, and they were ordered to pay that within a certain number of days, and they can't. And then a bench warrant issues for failure to pay, which compounds. There's a new bench warrant fee. And then there's a bond for them to pay to get out of the jail. It may be a small bond.
Just lost you. Yep. See your packet loss?
I had changed the screen.
Okay. Now you're up in the 60s and now it's coming back down.
Yes, 30, 23.
Yeah, I totally 14. Lost you. So go back to talking about the affluent. You use the word and it, like I couldn't quite get the affluent community out of my mouth.
Well, we were talking about the cycle of people who are in communities, and they're usually not offended.
Right.
Where these towns use their municipal law enforcement authorities to fund the government as a significant revenue source, and then it forms a vicious cycle because the people who assess these costs, although they're modest, can't pay them in a timely fashion, and they go to jail for a bench warrant, which triggers a whole new set of fees to get out of jail on the warrant. And it's a perpetual cycle that they dig deeper and deeper, and it's unfortunate, and it's a tragedy, and I agree with you that it's excessive, but what do we do about it?
Well, that goes to what we were talking very recently about: who puts those people into power, if not the people that are trying to extract those funds from those kind of people?
Well, if you take, we've got in municipal elections, if it's a city, it's the city. If it's a county, it's the county, the citizens of the county. But you don't have full participation in lower economic echelons of our society. They're on the treadmill of trying to do their daily thing and keep ahead. And they just don't participate in voting the same way. So you, as a general rule, I think that you can say that the more affluent society, people in our society are more likely to be participants in the system because it's working for them and they feel confident that they need to get out and vote. The people who on the other hand, don't feel the system is working for them, it's a lot more difficult to inspire them to go out and vote. If you're at minimum wage and the state legislature in Missouri has nullified a law that they've passed at the city level saying that they're going to raise minimum wage, and the state as a whole has come in and told the city that you can't do that, they feel disenfranchised because they did exactly what we're talking about right now. They voted for things that they thought would be beneficial for them, and then the state came in and said, nope, you can't do it. We're nullifying you. So there's a lot of disenfranchisement of these people who are the victims of this stuff. If they voted, and if they were participants, then we would probably have a different outcome. But the politicians are happy to cater to those who vote,
right?
Because that's how they are in office. And they like to hear about low taxes. And low taxes, government still has to be funded. Unless you're the federal government, you have to fund your operations that people want. And cities want police protection. They want parks. They want senior citizen centers. They want the trash picked up. They want street lights. I mean, you name it, they want these things. But nobody wants to pay for them.
You and your information. All right. What about the length of time served? I read one study that for federal inmates, the time has doubled from 1988 to 2012, rising from an average of 17.9 months to 37.5 months. And this is across all the major categories of federal crimes, major categories: violent, property, drug, public order, which I don't know what that means, weapon, and immigration offenses. What would be the culprit behind, from that's the very end of the Reagan era up till somewhere in the middle of the Obama administration, that those times had doubled?
Well, the culprit would be primarily the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984.
Okay.
So that was applied to criminal conduct occurring after the Reform Act. So a lot of people that were in the pipeline in 84 would have been sentenced under the old guidelines. Because of ex post facto, you couldn't increase the penalty. You couldn't change midship. So a lot of people, it took a few years to work through the system. But just for point of reference, the number of people in federal prison doubled during the 8 years Reagan was president. There was enough of an impact to take the federal prison population from just shy of 20, right around 20,000 when he assumed office, to over 40,000, and it had remained at 20,000 for the 40 years preceding that. Roughly, you'd see a fluctuation of maybe 1,000, 1,500 inmates over a 40-year period of time from 1940 to 1980. But when the Sentencing Reform Act was passed, you all of a sudden had no parole. You all of a sudden had recommended guidelines the guideline book is so comprehensive that you would be astounded if you saw that. But you have this system that relegates everyone to prison. You remember Martha Stewart went to prison for lying?
Yes.
That was her crime. She misled an investigator.
Correct.
But the guidelines recommend she get prison. So that increase for doubling is directly in response to the sentencing guidelines that were put in place and the effect of those. And the Obama administration could not really change the guidelines per se, because that's an act of Congress. What they did do which began to suppress the prison population, is they changed things like the crack cocaine disparity. They were able to get Congress to cut that disparity down and reduce the sentences that were imposed for those drug offenses. And then they were able he used executive powers to commute times of people who had already been sentenced under the old sentencing standards for those drug offenses. If they'd served more than that amount of time and had behaved, he commuted a significant number. But the most important thing he did is he instructed the Department of Justice not to seek the highest level of charge that could be sought just for the sake of charging the most serious offense, and to not seek maximum penalties, including all the enhancements that can be applied for the career enhancement, all the crime points. So the Justice Department was seeking less in the way of penalties, which resulted in shorter sentences. So you had, for the first time in 40 years, the prison population went all the way up from 80 to 2011 or 12. Mm-hmm. And then we started having some decline in the federal prison population. That's all going to reverse here in the next year, because the new administration has reversed all those policies, and we've gone back to doing business the old way, which the old way, no matter which way you cock your head, whether it be sideways, forward, or backwards, you're going to get the result we got, which is an increasing federal prison population.
I just found a graph provided by the sentencingproject.org. And so really it starts to pick up in 74. It held roughly stable. This is nationwide, federal and local, or federal and state, 200,000 people. And then in 78, it just goes up like a hockey stick until looks like the peak is 2008 is where it peaked at 1.6. 2015 was 1.4 million people, almost 1.5 million people. So in the span of from 74 to 2015, it goes from 200,000 people to 1.5 million people.
So, and I was concentrating primarily on the federal system, which.
Yeah, I'm with you.
From 20,000 under at the end of Jimmy Carter's administration to about 220,000 at the peak of Obama's presidency before he started bringing it down. So that's a tenfold increase, which is, I think, greater than the national increase. But that federal prison population is going to start going up. This will be the last year of declines we will have in 2016 because of the machinery that was already in place. But when you move out into 2018 and 19, we're going to see the federal prison population increasing again because of the policies of the Department of Justice under President Donald Trump.
And that's not to change what the sentence is from the legislator side. That is to change from the previous administration saying, go easier on them, don't seek the maximum penalty. When, in contrast, Jeff Sessions just a couple months ago sent out a letter to all of his court systems to go for the maximum amount possible.
That is correct. There's been no change in terms of Congress enacting harsher penalties. Now there's some bills before them. Like I think they're gonna make the penalty for sexting, as we call it, increase the penalty for that, and encourage the states to adopt tougher penalties on juveniles who engage in sexting. But yeah, those are things that are when the direct control of the prosecution, which would be the executive branch, that people don't often understand that the prosecutor has a lot of impact. They don't determine what the severity level of a crime is. That's determined by the legislative branch. But what they do determine is whether they'll charge you with the most serious crime. If they've got the choice of a fourth degree felony or a third degree felony, they just doubled in my state the amount of time that they would have at their disposal. They could charge you with three counts, and two of the counts may be weak counts, and they could charge you with more serious felony. And all of a sudden, they've got more exposure because they've got 3 years on each count. They've got 9 years of exposure where they could have charged you with 1/4 degree felony where they would have had 18 months of exposure. So those are things that the Trump administration has changed. They want the maximum amount of charges, the most serious charges filed, and they want any type of enhancement that's available to the U.S. attorney. They want the U.S. attorney to seek those enhancements. That's completely opposite of what Obama's Department of Justice was doing, which had resulted in lesser sentences. So now, without any statutory changes, we will see harsher sentences because people are being charged differently and the enhancements will be sought where they weren't under the previous Department of Justice. Those are all executive actions. And people don't understand that. They say, well, it's the judge that imposes the sentences. It is the judge that imposes the sentence, but if the judge doesn't have three counts to sentence you for, he or she can't sentence you for three counts if the prosecutor only charged you with one. You follow that?
I do follow. If he only gets one count on his desk, he's going to sentence you with one. If he gets 10, he's going to sentence you with 10.
Well, right. He wouldn't have the same level of exposure, because if you can stack consecutive time and you've got 3 years of exposure on each count, you've got 10 counts, you've got 30 years. If you've got one count, you've only got 3 years. Yes, it's the judge that imposes the 3 years versus the 30, but the judge wouldn't have 30 years of his or her disposal if the prosecutor hadn't charged 10 counts. And that's the part our people miss. They say, well, you know, the judge imposed the sentence. Yes, the judge did. But the prosecutor had the ultimate control by how he or she charged.
How would you see making punishment equitable to the crime when you have varying degrees of the person being convicted, whether that's intellectual stability or family stability and so forth? I mean, you know, somebody that is, I don't even know, let's just say he's very emotionally, or she is very emotionally stable and strong. Putting them in prison may not really impact them that much, whereas someone who weak, I don't know what the right word would be, just someone that is much more fragile, you put them in there and it is hell. It is an awful environment for someone to be put in. Same thing goes with physically weak. When you put them in that kind of environment, they're going to be preyed upon versus someone that might be, you know, I did run into a football player, a professional football player. Nobody messed with him.
Well, that could happen for two reasons. It could happen because they respect and they were in awe. It could happen because they respected that he could probably take your business if he needed to.
Right.
And I don't know which of the two it was. Both of those things will serve you well if you have respect because they're in awe and that you're a hero and they would never think of letting anything happen to you. Or they could respect you because if they don't, they're going to get the hell beat out of them.
But I'm focused not specifically on that particular guy, but saying that you have these varying degrees of punishments in prison or punishment in general, whether, you know, maybe you avoid prison, punishment isn't equal to all people. You know, if you give everybody a 5-year sentence, it doesn't treat everybody the same. Some people, when they go to prison, they have commissary money. So, you know, the wonderful food that they serve in prison isn't that big of a deal because you can buy all the honey buns and soups that you want because your family sends you 50 or 100 bucks a month.
Well, I understand where you're headed with that, and it's absolutely terrible when you talk about prison environment, because each person who's in that environment has to try to adjust as best they can to a situation. And we don't go out of our way in most states to make the situation tolerable. Keeping inmates safe from abuse is just not real high on the priority. It should be, but it isn't. So what can be tolerated by one inmate? There's all these disparities in terms of what can be tolerated because of the factors you identified. Physical strength, a person who has a lot of charm. They may not have a lot of money,
right,
but they charm their way to getting things in prison. I've seen you. I'm sure you've seen cute, charming guys that can. You'll say, how the hell did you get that?
Right.
And I say, well, so don't worry about it. But I got it. I have my ways. Well, they got it because they're charming. That's another thing. So when you've got people in these environments, when they're caged and they're restricted, the punishment is extracting a toll of a varying toll on each inmate. Each individual's different. So a punishment of 30 days might be adequate for somebody, where a punishment of 30 days would be meaningless to someone else.
Right.
But then we get into an individualized analysis, and that's the reason why your computer won't work, because we can't analyze all these factors on a computer. Even if we had directives, statutory requirements that we analyze all these factors, which we don't, most courts don't anymore. They used to be a hesitance to send a person to prison that couldn't survive in that, but a lot of that hesitance has been swept by the wayside now. You do the crime, you do the time.
Right. But so, you know, there's an expression, should we punish an eye for an eye? So if you beat the crap out of somebody, do some sort of aggravated assault, should your punishment then be have the crap beat out of you?
Well, I think not in a civilized society. That's the whole point of having an organized society, is that that's not what our system's about. The system is supposed to be the collective wisdom of society coming together and standing between these two parties where there's been a victim and a victimizer, and figuring out how to deal with what's best for society. We care about the victim, but we also should care about society. We We've got a bad apple here. We've got one or two choices. We can lock the bad apple up for a long period of time and continue to have a bad apple every time that bad apple's released, or we can try to improve that individual so that we don't continue to suffer as a society and have to bear the cost. Unfortunately, the average citizen has lost sight of we benefit as a society by having people made productive rather than made lepers. And that's tragic because I tell people in my legislature, if we have everybody with a felony record and we make it impossible for people with felonies to work, I hope you realize you're cutting into the donating capacity. They're going to be donating. Those are the people that you need to donate into the systems to keep us all healthy as we age and as we require medical care, hospital care, even hospice care in our dying days. Somebody has to pay the taxes. And I can tell you one thing, I'm not a mathematical genius. I struggle a lot. But I just have this belief that if a person's earning minimum wage, they will not be able to put nearly as much into the system as this person who's earning 10 times minimum wage. And I have a belief that a person's being locked up in prison, their contribution to the good of society is virtually zilch. So I want to take these people to the extent we can and make them productive and make them valued in society. But that doesn't seem to be where the people are. That's not what the public wants.
We can probably leave it right there.
Well, we've only been on for an hour.
I know. We could go on and on and on, but I run out of hard drive space. So, Larry, I want to thank you again for joining me and another enlightening conversation. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to the next one.
Well, it's my pleasure, as always, being with you on this podcast. I'm looking forward to the next one.
Have a question? Send an email message to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or leave a message at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website at registrymatters.co. This is episode 7. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you liked the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.